And now I'm going to introduce Jeff Albright from SUNY Upstate Medical University, New York, to finish up the Tales from the Backside, External Hemorrhoids Exposed.
All right, well, I'd like to thank Dr. Gerland and Dr. Beatty for inviting me to speak today, and it's great to see a large number of people out here. This is one of the good things about being the last speaker is everybody else has already told you everything I've got to say, so we can go through things a little bit more quickly. So I've got no disclosures. Talking about external hemorrhoids in this talk, I'm going to cover a few different things. Part of it's going to be external hemorrhoids, and the other portion is going to be kind of the perioperative pain management for any type of anal rectal procedure, because I thought that would be kind of a good take-home type of information for this. One of the more common things you have is a patient who shows up, and either they'll be self-referred or referred by one of the other doctors, and they, of course, are going to come in telling you that they've got hemorrhoids as their symptoms. And as they've seen from a lot of these other talks earlier today, is that there's such a large variety of conditions that everybody basically describes as hemorrhoids, and so you really just have to find out what specifically do they mean by that type of a problem. And, you know, we all get those patients that come in who really have a very florid description of what they've got going on, and you know, of course, it's just really going to require you to look at it in order to determine what's happening, and sometimes you think you're going to find something that's akin to looking at a bonobo's bottom when they come in, and you know, almost expect for it to be bursting into flames, but you know, a lot of times when you have patients who present with pain, it does end up being a variety of different things. And it's not always just going to be the external hemorrhoids. And in fact, I'll joke with the residents, when we've got a clinic full of anal rectal conditions, that probably about only 15 to 20% of the people that are referred for hemorrhoid symptoms actually have hemorrhoids as their true etiology for the condition. And so, well, common things we'll see is the perianal abscess, the thrombosed external hemorrhoid. Or more nefarious things like anal cancers can arise. For patients who come in with more just the external types of symptoms, of course, there's going to be pruritus ani. You're going to see patients who come in with anal warts, anal fissures with sentinel pils, and hypertrophic papillae. And so there are a variety of things that we really have to sort through, and often it just requires laying eyes on the condition in order to determine what's going on. And so this diagram, of course, shows the anatomy. Primarily looking at the external sites, we're dealing with an area that's covered by anoderm. It's going to have somatic nerves. And so that a lot of that really kind of determines what we can do for therapy for these patients, because we're not dealing with something up on the inside where you really have just more the visceral nerves that are providing the innervation of the site. And so with a lot of our patients, as you've already heard, we can deal with a lot of different approaches, and one of the most common things we can do that has the lowest risk is just ask them to alter some aspects of their lifestyle. You know, ask them to avoid constipating things like alcohol, fatty foods, straining on the commode, have them drink plenty of liquids. So very low risk can be beneficial for a lot of patients, just the education side of things. How about fiber? Fiber, of course, is another thing that we preach. If colorectal surgeons had a nickel for every time we said fiber, we'd probably double our income. But we have to really kind of consider what we're going to be getting with this. And of course, it being low risk and relatively high benefit, you know, you can offer it to a lot of people. And when they looked at a meta-analysis on the utilization of fiber for people with hemorrhoid symptoms, they found that overall they decreased, quote, persistent symptoms by about 47%, and this finding was significant in the meta-analysis. More specifically, though, when you look at the types of symptoms that people may be describing when they come in, if they're talking about bleeding, it may decrease that rate by half. And so with those confidence intervals, that was one of the few things that we found that fiber actually does have a statistically significant impact consistently across these studies, whereas things like prolapse, which is more of an anatomical factor for patients, you know, you wouldn't expect for that to have as much of a benefit from the fiber, even though it does show a relative risk of about, risk reduction of about 21%. Looking at other things like pain and itching, again, you can the risk ratios look good, but these are also non-significant findings in the meta-analysis. And so it's something where you can tell patients that you may get some benefit, but don't be surprised when you see these people back. And what I'm trying to highlight from this last part here is that the bleeding and the prolapse, you're primarily dealing with internal hemorrhoid types of symptoms, and so which are the ones where it appears that fiber tends to be a little bit more reliably effective as opposed to the external symptoms of pain and itching, which may be a little bit more or less successful for patients. With these simple measures not being overly successful. There were, as you can tell, stem cells, other types of treatments we have for a lot of these different conditions. We kind of look for a lot of different things that are available. And so phlebotonics are plant-derived compounds that they think its main impact has to do with the impacting the microvasculature, improving lymphatic drainage from the area. And there's some evidence that it may be beneficial for bleeding, itching, and recurrence. But again, it's not the data aren't great for a lot of these factors. And finally, sitz baths. If your patient gains some degree of relief from squirting warm or cold water under their anal area, by all means, let them do it. They're probably not going to harm themselves. But there really isn't great data to indicate that they're going to really get much benefit from it. Again, as Dr. Olson referred to, we have lots of different topical agents. For your more patriotic ones, they can have Americaine. There just isn't great data to indicate that these patients are really going to benefit from it. If it helps, great. If not, you'd be happy to see them back. This picture of thrombosed hemorrhoid always kind of makes me laugh. My wife is a stroke neurologist, and she likes to remind me how many brain cells die every minute during a stroke. And I try to tell her the converse, and she doesn't really think it's a very funny joke. We've got different options for treating people with thrombosed hemorrhoids. We all get those patients who come to our office and they want to find out, what happens if I do nothing? They're having pain right now. Maybe it's reached that plateau point at about 2 or 3 or 4 days where it's really not getting any worse. Most commonly we're going to recommend treatment for people within the first 2 or 3 days if we're going to do something surgical for them. And studies have been done on this to look at what happens if you treat somebody with non-operative management. And they find that the overall pain symptoms that people have associated with it, on average, take about 24 days for it to resolve if you just do nothing versus 4 days if you do excision. And so in that sense, at least you can give them some type of guidance with this. When you look at excision versus just doing a clot evacuation versus treating with a topical cream, and in the study they looked at with this, the cream was lidocaine with nifedipine. Overall, when they looked at symptom relief at 4 days or pain relief at 4 days, excision of the hemorrhoid with the clot included was superior. The next in line with that was the topical therapy with the lidocaine and nitroglycerin. And then the third place came to clot evacuation. So for those of you that do clot evacuation, you may consider excision as potentially a more successful approach to taking care of those patients in the office. And finally, other options. One of the other studies I found looked at using lidocaine plus or minus nifedipine, and they found that the nifedipine group actually had quicker resolution of symptoms when they looked at them at 4 days. So there does appear to be some benefit for patients for thrombosed hemorrhoids by decreasing that anal tone with either nitroglycerin or nifedipine. Now moving on to perioperative pain management, because I think that this plays an important role in how happy our patients are going to be afterwards. Similar type of findings, we think that perhaps the anal tone and anal spasm may play a role for patients as far as their overall postoperative pain. And so in a meta-analysis looking at nitroglycerin for perioperative pain issues, they found that there is benefit, but it does come with that risk of headache. Another study looked at cholestyramine, 15% ointment. And one of the rationales for this is, as you're all aware, cholestyramine is a bile acid binding agent. And the thought is that since bile is a fairly strong detergent, and it can be a fairly strong irritant when it gets onto the perianal skin or an open wound after an operation, it can cause significant irritation. And when they looked at 24 and 48 hours after surgery, for people who are applying this BID to TID, that they had a clinically significant decrease in perioperative pain on a 10-point pain scale. And that's opposed to other agents like sucralfate or diltiazem, where although they found a statistically significant reduction in the pain score, clinically having a pain score drop by 1 point probably isn't worth the effort. And so the final thing is that I want to bring your attention to is, you know, what's the best evidence? There's a lot of information out there, and getting it from a more of a curated type of a location can be beneficial. Prospect is a website that I found. It's a procedure-specific post-operative pain management. They have a section on hemorrhoid surgery as well as a number of other types of surgeries, and I recommend that people go to this webpage if they've never heard of it. And it's basically the Oxford collaboration on evidence-based medicine, and they basically use Cochrane collaboration approaches to identify what the best information is out there for perioperative pain management. And so primarily what the recommendations are with everything else that we do is they're using kind of a multimodal pain management approach. And so rather than relying primarily on narcotics, we're looking at using perioperative steroids, COX-2 inhibitors or NSAIDs, acetaminophen, laxatives. They found that oral metronidazole is superior to topical metronidazole, and so consideration of adding that into your armamentarium. And then pudendal blocks are actually considered to be superior to just local infiltration, so identifying that ischial spine and injecting 1 centimeter posterior and 1 centimeter medial to it in order to try to get a good pudendal block. Intraoperatively, again, multimodal pain management. And then depending on the type of operation that the patient requires, if it's appropriate to do like a stapled or a sutured hemorrhoidopexy because it's a non-excisional therapy for internal hemorrhoids, or if you do have to do excision, consider doing a Ferguson closed hemorrhoidectomy as opposed to the Milligan-Morgan open procedure because it does have the associated lower pain scores afterwards. And then finally, postoperatively, again, multimodal therapy using laxatives or oral metronidazole and some type of a topical therapy with consideration for using nitroglycerin or cholestyramine as an adjunct agent. Thank you.
Stay up. Let's call the speakers up.
Yeah. Thanks to all the speakers. We're going to call them up to the podium to do a short panel session. So if anybody has any questions, please gather around the microphones. Dr. Wolf, could you kindly describe how you do Botox for Fishers?
Absolutely. So first of all, it can be done in the office setting. Patient ideally is prone on the table. I use either 20 or 40 units of Botox on either side, lateral injection to the intersphincteric space. But as I mentioned, it's been described in various ways. Up to 100 units. Some people do it into the muscle directly for quadrant injections. So a variety of techniques.
Do you use any local before?
If it's in the office, yes. Otherwise, sometimes I'm doing it in the endoscopy suite, in which case they're under propofol. So
first microphone over there.
Yes, hi. I actually have two questions. The first one is, how do you manage anticoagulants around a banding procedure? And the second one is just, what is the role of setons in definitive management of fistulas?
So far as anticoagulants, if it's a planned procedure, ideally stop it 3 days before and 3 days after for the minimum. But if the patient is bleeding and there is an issue, and if you're just doing something like a rubber band ligation, I have done it, but you just have to tell the patients that there's a chance of causing more bleeding. But you have to just put only one band where it's bleeding then.
Because my issue is sometimes the bleeding happens a week after when the band falls off.
Right.
And they're already back on the anticoagulant, so is that an issue?
It's not been an issue, but if there's patients on, if the patients have had a history of having some bleeding in the past, then I would definitely caution them to keep up the to be off of it for a longer time. But usually we never have them more than 5 days. It's never been such a major issue. And so far as the setons go, if you're doing any procedure like the lift or the flap, you should have a seton in there for at least a minimum of 6 to 8 weeks before you follow up with another procedure. That's to make sure that there's no infection, that the tract is well epithelized, and your chances of having a better outcome for your planned procedure.
Thank you.
Next microphone.
What, if any, topical agents are you using for in-office procedures like thrombosed hemorrhoids or abscesses, et cetera, before you use lidocaine? Anything particularly?
I actually don't use any, but I've had the occasional patient where we'll get Emla cream or something like that in order to make them a little bit more comfortable, but it's kind of the minority of patients, in my opinion, that I've had to do that for.
Dr. Olson?
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't really use any topical numbing agents in the office. So I haven't found them to be terribly effective.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you for the talks. Patients with portal hypertension and varices, other than tips, and I heard sclerotherapy, but in real life, I have not much to offer. Anything new on those patients?
No, for the varices, sclerotherapy is probably the safest thing to do. You can't do anything. You can't band them. You can't do anything else. Sclerotherapy works pretty well, and it's easy to do in the office. And usually, unless they're bleeding, you're not going to do anything.
Anybody else?
No. Okay. Yeah, nobody has anything to do for them. It's the bottom line. Not just you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Yeah, I have two questions. For acute hemorrhoidal crisis, when you have edematous, prolapse, grade 3 internal hemorrhoids, what do you think about the idea of just applying sugar or salt to help with decompression? And the second question is, in the case of pruritus ani, I've had really good results with no lotion and potion, and just eliminating complete chemical and mechanical irritation just by washing with water and keeping the area clean and dry.
I agree with you. Sugar works well on just prolapsed mucosa. You can use sugar. It's easy to do at home, especially if patients calling you. I just have a little better results with the Epsom salt and magnesium glycerin preparations. Yes, I agree with you about the lotions, potions, nothing on the bottom end. Sometimes you do need like a barrier cream just so that the patients wiping off everything there, so anything about.
Yeah, my perspective on the pruritus is somewhat akin to the dermatologist. If it's dry, make it wet, and if it's wet, make it dry. And generally, yes, telling people to eliminate any of the commercial substances and really do warm water washing and put the hair dryer on low to dry things off, pat dry. Sometimes just a cotton ball to the area will work. But a lot of times people also feel better being able to apply something back there. And again, it's one of those things that there's not a lot of science behind. It's really difficult for people to manage the hair dryer or air blowing dryer or even water irrigation when they're out and about as well. And that's sometimes where the barrier creams can be useful, just anecdotally.
All right, so that last question for the last question and the mic back there. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Hi, if I have a large perianal abscess and I didn't want to make a large incision and pack, and instead perhaps make two incisions and place a vessel loop, how do y'all do that and how long do you leave that?
So a vessel loop, I've done that too. It's just an alternative to using a Pezzer drain. It's a little more comfortable if it's a very big abscess. You could also just make one incision and leave a Pezzer drain in the abscess. There's lots of variability as to how long people leave anything that you're draining in, but most say up until there's no drainage out of it. So you can do it's like 3 days to 2 weeks is sort of what you see in the literature. But just as long as there's no pus coming out of it anymore.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thank you.